From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Outer Mission.
I live in the Nastro.
I live in the Mistro.
La Playa.
I live in the Transmission.
Haight-Ashbury.
I'm in the sunny but filthy Mission.
Coming up, we'll find out how young people are surviving in Oakland's most violent neighborhood.
Got a gun.
Did you say they could have a gun?
Most likely he has a gun.
Then, how an East Oakland librarian tried to create a safe space for young people.
There was a gunshot blast through one of the front windows, and that was the very first thing that I saw when I saw that library.
And a program that's trying to keep Oakland male students in school.
I mean, you hear all these things like, you know, go to school, stay in school, but nobody really actually teach you how to do those things.
Staying safe and staying in school, today on Cross Currents. In December 2012, after the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, the White House created a task force to come up with solutions to curb gun violence.
If we're going to change things, it's going to take a wave of Americans, mothers and fathers, daughters and sons, pastors, law enforcement, mental health professionals, and yes, gun owners, standing up and saying, enough, on behalf of our kids.
Today, the issue of gun violence still looms large in many communities, including those where shootings are a daily occurrence. Youth Radio's Denise Tejada reports on how young people are getting by in the East Oakland neighborhood where nearly a third of all shootings in Oakland happen.
Castlemont High looks like any other school, but inside, teacher Demetria Huntsman and 16-year-old Joseph Hopkins are deconstructing a shooting that happened out front. Just 30 minutes before I got there.
I wanted to find out from you guys, what was this lockdown that happened today?
It was gunshots.
We just like heard gunshots, and so then she dropped her stuff, and we just both turned around and just started running. Like, that's the closest I've ever came to almost like actually getting shot.
This after school group, Youth Alive, is one of many violence prevention programs serving the neighborhood. And the violence is daunting. Between March and October of last year, there was an average of 3 shootings a day within a mile and a half of Castlemont High, including one where bullets came through the front door. Trevor Watson is a 14-year-old student.
If I can wake up one day, walk outside with the possibility of being shot at any point in time, that's kind of nerve-wracking every day to do.
So you bring up a really good point, Trevor, because you feel that a school at 3:30 in daylight, just the thought of maybe that's not a safe place, that's a real difficult reality.
You can be at the most safest place that you think, and then some type of violence bust out.
In spite of the violence, kids we talk to say Castlemont High is one of the few places they feel safe. In part because the program's designed to help students cope with regular shootings, maybe even prevent them.
It's up to adults and professionals to help them understand and process it and respond to it appropriately so it can be a tool for learning and growth.
Alex Briscoe is the director of Alameda County Healthcare Services. In the Castlemont neighborhood, according to county reports, homicide is the leading cause of death for young people. The life expectancy for residents in this area is 10 years shorter than that of people living in the upscale Oakland Hills, just over a mile away.
We can tell you how long you're going to live by what zip code you live in.
It's not difficult for us to look at a map and realize where those most significant crimes are occurring.
That's interim Oakland Police Chief Sean Wendt. He says the police are exploring options to target the violence near Castlemont.
It's been an area that has had more than its share of shootings and homicides over the years. The city has 6 crime response teams, and I've taken 5 of those 6 crime response teams and assigned them to Far East Oakland.
Sitting on the steps in front of his apartment, 14-year-old Trevor Watson says the popping sounds of gunfire sometimes keep him up at night. To deal with it, he tries to ignore it.
I see stuff like that so often, it doesn't even affect me anymore.
But that stoic facade drops when a kid walks into the courtyard in front of Watson's apartment. He's holding something under his shirt. Watson leans in and whispers into my producer's microphone.
Got a gun.
Did you say that kid had a gun?
Most likely he has a gun.
Why do you say that?
Pretty much he just walked out of the house and I thought he was pulling up his pants at first. Then when he walked past, seeing he had, like, a handle in his hand.
While teenagers try to cope with threats around them, for little kids, it's more complicated. On a chilly Saturday morning, about 20 kids ranging from toddlers to teens run, climb, and squeal at a playground next to Castlemont High, while three security guards in bright yellow shirts look on. In April, there was a shooting nearby, and 6-year-old Paolo had to take cover.
I was scared.
What did you do?
I had to go inside the building.
Paolo's mom, Stephanie Pepitone, is the organizer of the playgroup. She says she's dedicated to the neighborhood and wants to stay. But the shooting was a wake-up call for her family.
In the same way that we all teach our children about fire safety, to stop, drop, and roll, it was the first time that we realized we had to do the same type of safety training for our son with regards to what happens when you hear gunshots. I still don't feel like I can let my son run around freely in our neighborhood, and it doesn't feel any different than it did 10 years ago.
When you have nothing to live for, you will die for anything, and we've proven that.
That's Alice Simmons. She's the executive director of Youth Uprising, which is the major community center in the Castlemont neighborhood.
They didn't create this situation, no matter how we try to blame them for the conditions in which they were born. They've inherited this failure from us as adults.
Seems like young people are slightly fearless nowadays.
They're not fearless. If you understand complex trauma, you understand that the response to fear is anger and violence. In fact, the young people are scared to death. They're carrying guns because they're afraid for their lives.
In 2012, Youth Uprising held a gun buyback the day after the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. They netted 700 guns. Last month, they held another buyback as part of a statewide initiative. 1,500 guns were collected. Simmons says these efforts fill a need, but the problem of gun violence can't be fixed quickly.
It took three generations to get here, and I think it's reasonable for us to think 15, 20 years we could see a difference, but not next year.
But for the young people we interviewed, they want to see a change in Oakland now. They want better public safety and an end to gun violence as an everyday threat. For Cross Currents, I'm Denise Tejada.
That story was produced by our partners at Youth Radio. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Like Castlemont High, the staff at the 81st Avenue Library in East Oakland has also been trying to create a safe space for people, young and old. Eric Hannon started as the teen librarian there when it opened back in 2011. He told our community storytelling project, Hear Here, about his first impressions at his new workplace.
So I had my own judgments about what it would be like to be in East Oakland. I had only driven through there a few times. I never really stopped and hung out too much. About a week before I went to start my first day at work, I drove by the library just to find out where it is, how do I get there. And as I was driving by with my girlfriend, there was a gunshot blast through one of the front windows. And that was the very first thing that I saw when I saw that library. It's kind of just how it is in East Oakland as I came to learn that is a way of life and something that the community there deals with every day. We had a henna tattoo program. It broke my heart when half the kids in the henna tattoo program got memorial tattoos. And this is, we're talking 12, 13, 14-year-old kids. And aunts, cousins, that was really challenging for me to deal with, to see the unnecessary suffering, basically, that these kids had to go through. That was hard. And to know that there's not a whole lot I can do outside the library about it, but I think that motivated many of the staff members there to really make that library something special through the connections that we had with the kids in our relationship. Building's great, the books are great, all that stuff's great, but it's nothing compared to the richness of the relationship we had as staff members with that community and with those kids. The best thing about interacting with young people is that they remind me of my inner young person, and I like that guy, and I want to stay in touch with him. So it's easy to just kind of forget and get older and colder and forget what it's like to be a kid and a young person and the life in front of you. Like, that's a really powerful place to be. And so being around those kids helps keep me feeling young and playing and having fun and doing the good things in life like that. And when I left that library, I cried for a month. Those were two of the best years of my life.
That was Eric Hannon, the former teen librarian at the 81st Avenue Library in Oakland. He shared his thoughts on the impacts of violence in East Oakland with our community storytelling project, Hear Here. His story was produced by Nina Gensler-Debs. Many Hear Here participants from East Oakland have shared ideas about how to make their neighborhood a safer place. Michael LaFall spoke with us about the importance of role models.
Without a doubt, I definitely idolize my uncle because he is the type of person that I would want to be and want to emulate. My uncle's name is Cleveland Williams. What he did was he became a cement worker in the Union, and he was really involved with some of the most historical projects, specifically here in this Bay Area. He would give us stories of not only the Bay Bridge or the Coliseum, but a lot of other freeway projects that he had been involved with. The Coliseum is all concrete. It's more forms, more pouring, more forms, more pouring, and just pouring concrete everywhere. It's pretty tedious. That's why I never did. Concrete's not my thing. What he continued to remind me of was the fact that I had to be a man. That was the number one issue, because manhood in these days is it seems pretty iffy for some people. I think they don't stand very, very strong on that issue. If you take responsibility for your behavior and your family and your community, you've done what you can in order to make that difference. You know, I'm a carpenter. I have a son too as well. And it means to me that I would want to pass what my uncle had passed to me, to my son, in order for him to have the type of life that he could grow from and continue to improve a life for himself and his family and his community. You know, when he turns 18 next year, hopefully he goes into the trades, I get him into the apprenticeship program, and then, you know, the cycle continues.
That was East Oakland resident Michael LaFall. He shared his story with KALW's Hear Here Community Storytelling Project. It was produced by Jeremy Dulmas. We want to hear your ideas on how to make East Oakland a safer place. Share your thoughts on our tip line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Keeping inner cities safe has been a challenge for decades in cities across the country. Another challenge? Keeping low-income neighborhood kids in school and engaged in education.
Man, you don't understand nothing. I mean, you don't come from where we live. You're not bused here.
Do you have a choice to get on that bus?
Man, you come and live in my neighborhood for 1 week, and then you tell me if you got a choice.
As portrayed in the 1995 film Dangerous Minds, it's hard to focus on school when your daily life includes gunfire, drug pushers, and absent parents. In 2012, nearly 30% of African-American students dropped out of high school in Oakland. That's about double the rate for all students statewide. And among the most likely to leave were young Black men. So last year, the Oakland Unified School District took it upon itself to challenge the status quo. It adopted the Manhood Development Program, a daily after-school class that aims to keep young men in school and help them build life skills. Reporter Angela Hopkins explains how this innovative program works in this story from our archives.
I'm walking alongside the mural called Beautiful Struggle in front of Oakland High School. Frida Kahlo, Che Guevara, and Malcolm X are just a few of many social activists portrayed here. This mural also reflects a student body made up predominantly of students of color. 51% are Asian, 29% black, 16% Latino, and 1% white. After I've entered the school's gate, guarded by security officers, I'm free to roam the hallway in search of the Manhood Development Program's office. It's here where I meet Mr. Tiago Robinson.
I dropped out in the ninth grade. I didn't have me when I was going in school. I couldn't relate to anyone.
Robinson has been running the Manhood Development Program at Oakland High since 2009.
I mean, you hear all these things like, you know, go to school, stay in school, but nobody really actually teach you how to do those things. It's just easier to say, hey, go to class.
Robinson doesn't just say, go to class. It's his job to teach these boys how to become men.
So manhood is just really just teaching them how to be a young man, how to be accountable for your actions.
How to be accountable, but also how to learn life's lessons.
You are going to make mistakes, but it's how you make your mistake and how you learn from your mistake and getting up and just striving to be the best that you can be.
Being the best you can be is no easy task. According to recent reports, 20% of African-American males are chronically absent, while suspension rates for African-American males are 6 times higher than that of whites. The Manhood Development Program is stressing the importance of education in the most realistic way possible.
My brother's 2 years older than me. He's 36 years old. He has been a gangster rapper since we were 14. Y'all find it funny, I know.
Wearing a variety of hoodies, blue jeans, and baseball caps, 14 young Afro-American men, along with Robinson, are gathered to hear Mr. Flagg speak. But this isn't just any ordinary classroom. This manhood development class is where guest speakers like Flagg come every week to talk about how education can provide options to the street life.
So my brother has been, you know, doing this for a long time, man. I came into the kitchen one time, my parents were going, he had a razor blade, he had an old, like, little aspirin or Excedrin or something. He was carving this thing up. I'm like, what are you doing?
Cutting rocks.
He's cutting some rocks, man. I tell the story to say he dropped out of school in the ninth grade. That was his last year of high school. Hayward High, he dropped out. And to make little ends meet now, he has a whole pickup truck. He drives around and he helps folks haul their stuff. That's his hustle.
Unlike his brother, Mr. Flagg is a college graduate and currently represents Hild College. Later during this visit, he will also discuss college programs the students may be interested in. But first, they'll have to get college ready. That's Jasmine Noble's job, another manhood development mentor.
We are preparing just, you know, for them to take exams so they know how to fill out the different CSUs, UC applications, community college.
College readiness is just one phase of the program. Getting through to them is another matter entirely.
Okay, you're dealing with 9th and 10th graders, you know. First of all, they don't know you. You have to build trust. You have to bridge that gap. So just giving them like a little history about me, they respect that because, again, it's like children, youth, they're going to watch you more than anything. You can give them a full hour lecture of all the scholarship opportunities you may have, but a student wants to know, how did you do it? You know, I'm coming from, how did you make this happen? And I think that's the most important thing that I can show. And I can come with resources that can be used.
Like her students, Jasmine grew up in Oakland's inner city and says she attended subpar schools. Eventually, however, she reached college.
I still kept my goal. You know, it took me 7 years to finish undergrad, but I had a goal and I stuck to it.
She stuck to it through hardship and grief. One of her brothers was murdered.
You know, and then I share that with my students sometimes, and they respect that because, unfortunately, you know, the natural cause of a lot of African-American males in the inner city communities is homicides, you know. So it's like, unfortunately, that's the topic of discussion. But I also let the students know that's not normal. That's, you know, that's something's wrong with that. And so I just use it as my motivation.
Utilizing motivation like that is one of the goals of the manhood development class. As I continue to sit in on the session, Mr. Flatt tells the inspirational story of African-American boxer Andre Ward, who grew up in the East Bay, trained at a gym in Oakland, and eventually fought his way to a gold medal at the 2004 Olympics.
For boxing, right, if you're in the gym, you prepare for a major title fight. Your gym, you might have one speed bag, an old kind of worn-out heavy bag, and that's about it, right? But the fighter you're training against, state-of-the-art facility. Can you still out-train that person?
Yeah.
Can you still put yourself in a better situation to help him fight?
Yeah.
What does it take?
Hard work.
Dedication.
Initiatives.
Oh, man, I love all those words.
Effort.
All of that. Hard work, initiative, dedication. All right. Now, some folks are in a fight. They don't even know they're getting ready for a fight. They don't even know that you're getting ready for a fight. So they're not even trained. They don't even hit the bag once.
Fighting your way through obstacles is one of the many themes of the Manhood Development Program. Jasmine Noble says hearing from successful black men is teaching them what it is to be a man.
Them also seeing, you know, black men who've went to college and just like seeing it for themselves.
Although there is no easy way out of Oakland's inner city, through hard work, initiative, dedication, and courage, these 9th and 10th graders have a fighting chance of making their dreams come true. Take a moment and listen to some of the dreams students shared with me.
My name is Barry Williams, and what I see myself doing is being an owner of Sony.
My name is Jesse, and I see myself as a fire chief and a doctor.
My name is Kenneth. I see myself going into the Navy.
My name is Naquan. I see myself as somebody in criminal justice, a lawyer, or a chef.
My name is Byron, and I see myself as an engineer.
My name is James, and I see myself being a lawyer.
My name is Rico, and I want to be an engineer.
My name is Tiago, and I see myself doing what I'm doing.
Which is trying to steer his Oakland High students to college and success beyond high school. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Hopkins.
The Manhood Development Program will be offered at 16 Oakland high schools by the spring. Find more information about it at our website. Go to klw.org and click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now it's time for StoryCorps Griot. E.W. Wainwright grew up in Baltimore in the 1940s. As a child, he loved music and was known to finger drum on the neighborhood mailboxes. Later in life, E.W. became a professional drummer. He moved to the South and joined a jazz band that was touring throughout Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia. One time while on the road between gigs in the 1960s, his tooth started to hurt. It got worse as the days went by, and when he couldn't take it any longer, he and his bandmates started looking for a dentist. They found one, but as he tells his friend Lisa Sutton in this archive interview from Oakland's StoryCorps Griot Project, what started as a toothache turned into some serious trouble.
It had to do with being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. I had an abscess tooth in my head, and we were coming into Chattanooga, Tennessee, and there was an ad on the radio which said, come to, you know, I forgot what the name of it was, but Dr. John's dentist, no appointment necessary, just, you know, come in. So we found it, you know, driving around, we found it, and they just dropped me off, you know, in front of the place, you know, and they went asking and looking for a hotel, because you had to stay on the other side of the tracks, remember? Mm-hmm. So we had to find a black motel. There was only one, right? Mm-hmm. So they left me there. It turns out it's a white dentist, right? And it turns out that the dentist who runs the place, who the head dentist, was the nephew of the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, okay? So they get me in the dentist chair, right? Well, I had been drinking brandy putting it on the tooth, because that's what we used to do when we're on the road, to deaden the pain. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine that my attitude might not have been as conciliatory, might not have been the best attitude mm-hmm. to end up in the Ku Klux Klan dentist's shop, you know. But there I was. And so they got me in the chair, and they just, you know, they beat me and they sewed an abscess up in my head, you know. So I was in excruciating pain, and that abscess poisoned all of my sinuses. I have no sinuses. We went to Atlanta because they told me that in Chattanooga, there's nothing we can do for you. There's no lawyer that will take your case. There's no dentist that will do. They said, there's nothing we can do for you here. And so when I got to Atlanta, Atlanta says, well, it's out of state. So there's nothing we can do for you here, you know, but, you know, we can get you some medical care. And later I had to have an osteoplastic flap done where they open up the front part of your head, raise up the flap, drill through the skull to take out the polypoid mucosa, and then take subcutaneous tissue from your stomach and redo your forehead, you know, so that I look as handsome as I do today.
E.W. Wainwright is now a master jazz drummer and curriculum developer for the San Francisco and Oakland Unified School District. And you can see just how handsome he is on Friday night when he plays music from his new album at the Jazz School in Berkeley, along with John Santos and Destiny Muhammad. Show starts at 8 o'clock. And that wraps up today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes David Boyer, Jeremy Dalmas, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Pfeffer, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Mary Willis. Today's show is produced by Audrey Dilling and engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.